Hello and welcome to I Am The Egg Pod with me, Chris Shaw. The Egg Pods take a jaunty stroll through Pepperland, discussing the Beatles and solo Beatle albums with a potpourri of delicious guests. In this episode, the second part of Anthology 2, it's a welcome return to broadcaster, writer and podcaster, Jeff Lloyd.
Hello, I hope I didn't already exhaust people with my rambling on about disc one.
I wasn't convinced we'd be able to do the whole thing in one podcast, I have to be honest.
And I was. I think I said right at the end of the last one, I said, when you asked me to do it, I was flattered, but I thought, I've got nothing to say, really. I love the music, and I've spent a lot of time reading about it and just enjoying it, but I don't know that I've got anything interesting to say. I still don't know that I actually had anything interesting to say, but there was certainly a lot of it, wasn't there?
There was. It was lovely. At the end of the last episode, we ended with a pretty lackluster performance of She's the Woman at the Budokan. Turning over to the second disc, it's been an unprecedented five-month break. Paul was doing film soundtracks, Lennon was doing How I Won the War, George learning the sitar, Ringo, I think, popped over to see John in Spain, and then we start with the demo of Strawberry Fields Forever, which was recorded at Kenwood's.
This period, 1967, and I know we're at the real back end of 66 really, but we're talking about the Beatles' output in 1967, and it just, is there a more mind-blowing year in their existence? And I feel that at some point it became unfashionable to think of Sgt. Pepper as the best Beatles album. People would tend to say it's Revolver or Abbey Road, but it's still extraordinary nonetheless. But what they managed to do in 1967, to cram into one year, it's too much. When you go through the timeline of it, the greatest 7-inch single ever released, Penny Lane on one side, Strawberry Fields Forever on the other side. Then How I Won the War comes out. They record and release Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band.
Yeah.
Brian Epstein dies.
Yeah.
They meet the Maharishi. George goes off to, I think, India and San Francisco to see what's going on with the scene over there.
Yeah.
They do All You Need Is Love, this televised worldwide satellite link up with this, the song of the era.
Yeah.
And then Magical Mystery Tour, as well as a Christmas single in Hello Goodbye. Oh, I mean, that year doesn't make sense. How did they do it, even by their standards?
And they ended it, they were going to look at buying a Greek island as well.
Of course.
Just to end the year.
Yeah, it's astonishing.
Do it.
Starting off with Strawberry Fields Forever. For me, when Anthology 2 came out, there were a few things that, or the whole Anthology series really came out, there were a few things that were the standouts. And probably the one was the evolution of Strawberry Fields Forever. And this first version, which is just John making a home demo, it's not just beautiful because of how fragile his voice is, but what you hear is John Lennon talking to himself, which is a whole other thing to what we're used to. He's not being caustic, he's not giving orders on how he wants something, he's just gently chastising himself.
Can he do it?
It's just the loveliest thing.
Understanding all you see, it's getting hard to be someone, but it all works out. doesn't matter much to me.
And then as we listen through the, you know, the following tracks, Take One is just magical. And then just getting an idea of what was asked of George Martin in gluing the two bits that shouldn't go together, gluing those two versions of the song together. It's just extraordinary. It's I can't remember how much the CDs were at the time, but certainly expensive, a double album by the Beatles. I mean, these weren't things that were sold at reduced prices, but worth it just for those first three tracks on disc two of this album.
Yeah. What gets me, because obviously the Kenwood demo at the beginning, before that, back in autumn 66, when he was filming How I Won the War in Spain, he was doing demos there.
Yeah.
And Ringo came over for his 26th birthday, which means that he was composing Strawberry Fields Forever when he was 25 years old.
You can't start thinking like that, because then you try and picture a 25-year-old. You think, okay, you're out on the street, you think of a 25-year-old and think, how did they do it? That's not what a 25-year-old does. But, I mean, they were superhuman. We have to accept they were superhuman and not obeying the general rules that the rest of us have to abide by.
Because Take One as well is so sweet and pure, and it's the difference between Take Two of Across the Universe at the end of this album and the Phil Spector production. Yeah. It's sort of like something from Rubber Soul almost.
But I think with Across the Universe, and we'll come on to, you know, this is, we'll finish with this, but with that, that version is the best version.
Yeah.
Whereas with Strawberry Fields Forever, it's beautiful hearing these early takes, but, you know, as ever with the Beatles, or almost as ever with the Beatles, the finished product they had the taste to know when to stop. And that, you know, whatever, and I know we talked about this the last time, I know John had his sort of gripes in the 70s and talked about how horrendous the productions were and he wanted to make them all again, but the finished Strawberry Fields Forever is perfect. And we're just so lucky that we got to see this glimpse of the evolution of it on this album.
Track three. The start of that is what we now know and love, with that mellotron playing at the beginning. But it's interesting to hear it all the way through, because it doesn't really, it stays in that feel.
Mm.
It doesn't really build and build. You, when you're expecting it, let me take you down, the cellos come in. Doesn't happen. It just carries on that plateau.
Yeah.
But it's all the better for it. It's,
yeah.
Oh, we're still here, surrounded by this cozy psychedelia. But the end of this flown in is the end drums. And the faster version, which happens quite a lot on this disc.
I know what you mean, and we did talk about this last time, and I am pleased that the anthology CDs exist in the form that they came out in the 90s. I think it's far better than the single album of stuff. That was, you know, but, you know, I think we're also lucky that now, 50 years on, as they're revisiting the albums like they did with Sgt. Pepper and the White Album, and as they will, I have it on very good authority, with Abbey Road later this year.
Can you give us any more?
I overheard something.
All right.
In a Beatle-related location. That's all I heard.
Okay.
I mean, I say I have it on good authority. I was sort of listening at a door, basically. But I'm pretty sure we're going to get it.
Okay.
Yeah. But they don't feel the need to do that. So the bonus discs on the White Album reissue, for example, go really deep. And there's no pressure to polish it up or give us a mainstream audience friendly version of it. So I think we'll get what we're after.
Penny Lane, I would say, this is another kind of composite and remix and whatever, but the version that we got on the Sgt. Pepper box set, I would say, even for the casual listener, is far more interesting.
Mm.
It's almost like a Brian Wilson production.
This one, you've just got a bit of variation, really, in the brass in the middle. It's a bit more swinging, which... I think the difference is how hands-on the Beatles were with the anthology,
yeah,
versus how hands-off. I think, you know, they get their tick, and I'm sure they make their opinions known. But I think back then there were still three of them around. George Martin was still around and overseeing the thing, and they just couldn't understand that people wanted to see them with their pants down. Mm. You know, they were. I was talking to on the one of the other podcasts that I do. Billy Bragg came in for a chat, and I was talking to him, and I said this idea that I think I mentioned to you the last time, that we talk about just the sort of economics of the music industry. And I was saying Beatles fans would pay a lot of money, and we talked about this last time, to have access to all those master tapes and be able to fiddle around with it ourselves and hear all the different takes. And he sort of made fun of me a bit for being an anorak. And I don't think musicians can understand that you'd want to pull their songs apart in that way.
Yeah.
I think it's something that we as fans, it makes a lot of sense to us. But I don't think to the three Beatles and George Martin in the early 90s, I think it was sort of odd to them that people would want to hear mistakes and flubs and unfinished songs when, you know, they work so hard to give us these brilliant records. I think there's a touch of that to it, perhaps. But, you know, I like the bit at the end of Penny Lane where he says, a suitable ending, I think.
Yes.
I mean, you know, that's good to hear, isn't it? It has been interesting with these box set reissues of the albums to look at the stuff that didn't end up on the anthology and then ask the question, I wonder what was going on there then.
I suppose the difference between a box set, you've got a limited from January to whatever, their whole career.
Yes.
I don't, especially, can you imagine George Harrison sitting through the entire Beatles back catalogue set? I'll take four slightly better.
No, perhaps not.
Yeah. I read the news today, oh boy, about a lucky man who made the grade. And though the news was rather sad, well, I just had to laugh. I saw the photograph.
Next, we have A Day in the Life, and this evolved from another 1966 demo John recorded at Kenwood, which I'm convinced is an early version of A Day in the Life, unfortunately called Hold On, I'm Coming. But check it out. Have a look. You listen to the beginning of that. I reckon that's A Day in the Life.
Can we pause to listen to it now?
Yeah, go on then.
So we've just listened. I just paused to listen to that, and I see what you mean. The guitar chords sound extremely similar.
Yeah.
It's a bit faster. The melody's different, but yeah. So what's the story with that then? When?
Well, that was another. That was just another Ken Woods recording from '66, end of '66. A lot of those flying about. Again, we were saying Ken Wood. There's probably tons more of that floating around, but these sort of eked out. I think this is for the Lost Lennon tapes,
right?
The radio show.
It is interesting where you hear things starting to evolve. Like, is it in the Get Back sessions where you hear the piano chords for Imagine being worked out?
Yeah,
and also bits of How Do You Sleep as well.
Yeah, there's also at the end
Give Me Some Truth or one of those ones.
Something, isn't it? It turns into the piano on Remember That.
Yeah.
So they're all there,
waiting
to be
molded into something. Yeah. And, you know, Yesterday he had Knocking About for ages, didn't he, before he made it into a song. So, yeah, that is a good theory. Something I remember reading in the books, although it doesn't seem to make sense to me when I now think about it, was so John had the main body of the song, and then Paul had that other song, and it ended up going in the middle. I seem to remember books years ago suggesting that Mal setting off the alarm clock, they still didn't know they were going to fly Paul's bit into the middle there, and it was just a coincidence that the alarm went off, and then Paul sings Woke Up, Fell Out of Bed.
Yeah.
I don't believe that now, thinking about it. It doesn't make any sense. It makes sense that the alarm clock is there to show...
Yes.
You know, when the whatever goes in the gap, which we now know to be that orchestral climax, that's when it needs to be over by. But it's no coincidence that the alarm goes off and Paul sings Woke Up. But I think they tried to sell us that for a while. Somebody went with that idea for a while.
Until the bootlegs came out. Hold on a minute.
Yeah.
I think, because it was just really for the space for the orchestra, wasn't it? They weren't really sure what they were going to do with it.
Yeah.
They put that in. They knew what they were doing.
Mm. And again, we talked before about John's count-ins and just the thrill of hearing them in the studio. And this was another one of those things when you first heard Anthology 2. It's just wonderful to hear the, you know, have that mic down on the piano and the maracas and Sugar Plum Fairy.
Yeah.
It's so special.
There's a whole load of little Beatle quotes now that have come into folklore, like Sugar Plum Fairy and Paul's Broken a Glass. From the anthologies.
Yes.
There's a lovely video of George Martin listening to the opening of this song with the
Sugar
Plum
Fairy. Yeah, was that from the Sgt. Pepper South Bank Show documentary?
I think it was,
maybe.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, he's just... listening to it, and you can just see him taking it all in, and then I miss John, that little moment, and then he's back on it. What a great, lovely man.
Yeah, lovely man. And he seemed, you know, on the face of it, to have an appreciation for what they did, to understand what a body of work that was.
Not wishing to bleat on about the composites, but the ending that we got on the Sgt. Pepper version with the hum, surely that would have been, even for a casual listener, more interesting.
Because on this, you just end up with a bunch of studio chat where Paul's kind of talking to the orchestra as they're tuning up.
He's going to say, well, what you've got to think about this, it's not been done before.
Well, I mean, again, put yourself in their shoes. If they did that hum and, you know, one or more of them thought it was a crap idea, and I'm sure if, say, George Harrison thought it was a crap idea, he would have said so. He hears it again 25 years later. I mean, he still thinks that's a crap idea.
Good morning. It's almost got like a Who sellout pop art feel to it.
Yeah, I mean, I still think, you know, I still prefer the finished version. As I said last time, with the exception of While My Guitar Gently Weeps, I don't think there's an example of a Beatles work in progress being better than the finished product. But it's never one of my favourite songs, Good Morning, Good Morning. And I think part of that is... because of the watching the skirt, you start to flirt line. And I think an interesting thing about the Beatles is, even though, you know, they epitomise the times they were living in, actually there's not that much in there, even lyrically, which is sort of dated and you know, slang of the day. And the watching the skirt just, it makes it a bit too much of a period piece for me, like a sort of an Alfie or an Austin Powers or something. Yes.
You can picture John lying at home watching telly doing absolutely nothing. But lyrically, it's really strange because it's nothing to do to save his life. Then how's your boy been? It's up to you. I've got nothing to say. It's about him. It's about you. It's about me. It's all over the place lyrically.
Yeah,
really
almost sloppy. So something I meant to mention before when we talked about Penny Lane, and this is if my wife was here, she would do a better job of describing this. But often we'll be, you know, going for a walk, or we'll be out and about, or she'll be sitting there reading the paper, and then I will just blurt something out, and it's just some question about the Beatles or some observation about the Beatles, and like she says, it is amazing to me how much of your neutral is just sitting there thinking about the Beatles. and I've been thinking about Penny Lane a bit recently because my 3-year-old really likes it. And don't you think it's weird that the fireman rushes in from the pouring rain, but it's the banker who doesn't wear a Mac?
Yeah.
Why is the fireman rushing in? He has a Mac as far as we know. Why has nobody ever asked Paul McCartney this? So you know, that's one of those sort of lyrics. I'm sure a lot of this stuff isn't deliberate. Not just Hunter Davies' biography, but the book that he brought out a few years ago, which was about the lyrics he'd collected and bits of scraps of paper, some of which are now in the British Museum, demystifies some of the songwriting process in a way that I found a little bit upsetting. So he was talking about With a Little Help from My Friends, and I will take the Beatles version over the Joe Cocker version because I love the call and response. You know, I love hearing them respond to Ringo's lead vocal. And I really like the line, what do you see when you turn out the light? You know, I can't tell you, but I know that it's mine. I've always thought that's quite profound. Yeah. And then according to Hunter Davies, who was sitting there as they were writing it, it was a knob joke.
Yeah.
It's about a penis. And I think there's so much of that in Beatles lyrics that we who scrutinize.
Some of the mystery is just gone.
It's just sort of schoolboys smirking. I interviewed Hunter a while ago for this Beatles show I do for American radio, and went round to his house in North London. And he's a lovely, lovely man. And he says, I've got something to show you. He says, what? So he goes over to a filing cabinet. I mean, it's astonishing. You'd love to see it because he's one of these people who hoards everything. Oh, wow. So all his notebooks when he was spending time with the Beatles and their families, it's all there. And of course, the reason that he ended up with this priceless collection of lyrics is he would pick them up at the end of recording sessions because nobody thought about the posterity of these things. Anyway, so he's sort of rummaging through this filing cabinet and he tells me a story about, it sounds like it would be 1969, and he's got a house in Portugal and he's staying out there with his wife and his kid. And the story goes that Paul gets together with Linda. Linda's got her daughter, Heather. Paul thinks, who do I know who has a kid that Heather could hang out with? Oh, Hunter Davies. Uh-huh. So Paul gets on a private plane, flies to Portugal. All he's got is Hunter's address. He doesn't tell him he's coming. He's just sort of, you know, tracked him down. He gets in a taxi, but of course, because he's a Beatle, he doesn't carry money. In the middle of the night, Hunter Davies is woken up by all this shouting and screaming outside his bedroom window, and it's Paul standing there asking for some money to pay this taxi. Oh, no. Which so Hunter's telling me the story, and as he kind of gets to that bit, he pulls out a sealed plastic bag, and in there are a pair of swimming trunks. Right. And so Paul stayed, I think, for a couple of weeks, but didn't take his bathing shorts home with him. And Hunter saved them and kept them in a plastic bag.
Really?
Yeah.
Has he washed them since?
I don't think so.
dear.
Like, if you want to clone Paul McCartney, I'm sure there's plenty of DNA in there you could scrape. Yeah. But I don't even think it's... Like, I think with most people that would be a creepy thing to do, but I think, you know, he's obviously this very fastidious journalist and he just hangs on to things.
Yeah. Ringo's drums at the end, he puts in a blistering performance for that, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Because I think... Why I like this version so much, not so much now with the new Giles Martin remix, but the one that we had for years, there was so much more overdubbed on with the brass. It kind of lost some of that raw power.
Yes.
The drums weren't quite as...
It was all a bit squashed in, wasn't it? A bit sort of overly compressed. I think what's interesting about the Sgt. Pepper reissue is the thing that jumps out at you is the drums and the bass, and it's almost like the surviving members of the Beatles. Yeah, that thing about bands, they always want their own instrument turned up.
Yeah, it's just going to be instrumentals eventually. Yeah. Turn John down.
Not. I just wrote it.
Next, we have Only a Northern Song. George, again, during the process of picking the songs, high percentage of his recording output with the Beatles are on these anthologies.
Which, of course, is, I mean, that's going to be the negotiation of the whole thing, the internal Apple wranglings.
Although Ringo's got 100% of his compositions.
Right, yeah, so of course.
Fair play to him.
Although no, taking a trip to Carolina.
No.
Yeah. No. So, I mean, it's a funny one, Only a Northern Song, isn't it? Just that there's two separate things going on for me. One is that George felt it was suitable material for a song for public consumption. His own gripe about the way the publishing is set up within his band. Yeah. And secondly, I think it says something about the hierarchy and communication in that band, that rather than have it out, he writes a song about it, which is the most passive-aggressive thing.
Yes. Which he's quite known for. But it was going to be on Pepper. It was penciled in between Fixing Hole and Benefit.
Yeah.
It was going to be on Pepper.
Yeah.
It's got the psychedelia, but it's quite bitter.
It is. But, you know, George can have a bit of that. In his lyrics anyway, but I mean this is very specific. Subject matter aside, I quite like it. It's only a Northern Song, you know, the swirly psychedelic thing, which we see again in stuff like It's All Too Much and Blue Jay Way. You know, he's enjoying having to play with an organ, isn't he?
He does. He loves it.
For the benefit of Mr. Kite, there will be a show tonight on trampoline. Hendersons will all be there. Lady Pablo Frank is where. What a scene. Over men and horses, hoops and garters, lastly through a hogshead of real fire. In this way, Mr. K will challenge the world.
So being for the benefit of Mr. Kite.
Being for the benefit of Mr.
Being
Kite.
Being for the benefit of Mr.
As
Kite.
As John corrects.
He does.
I don't know, who would that have been? Jeff Emmerich or someone? Yeah. I'm not sure.
What's interesting about this at the beginning, Paul, who is clearly taking over. I think John's intake of LSD at the time, he was deliberately losing his ego at the time, and you can hear it here, and Paul's pretty well instructing him how to sing it, how to perform it, how to do the vocal stylings. And John's very subservient. He's going, I'm 10 Somersets. Yeah. I don't know, but Paul's fully taking control of this session.
Yeah.
Of well, John's song.
But it is the point where the balance of power tips, isn't it? Sergeant Pepper is the point. And I know it shifts back to some extent with the White Album, but it's the point at which Paul McCartney becomes the creative engine of the Beatles. And there it is. It's not just these magnificent songs of his own that are ending up on there. It's the way that he's having input in everything. And it's an interesting one, being for benefit of Mr. Kite, because it's one of the few that he contests in terms of the songwriting. He started playing it live in recent years and does a good old version of it. When it comes to songwriting, I mean, if you look at the poster, there's not that much writing going on. It is very faithful to it. I've got to show you downstairs when we finish. I've got a pretty good reproduction of the Mr. Kite photo. There was a printer a few years ago sort of set about a project to print and produce some replicas of the poster as close to the original as possible using the same printing methods.
Really?
Yeah, and it's a really beautiful thing. It was, you know, a little expensive, but I just thought, so I'm not a great one. I've got shelves of books and box sets and things behind you, but I'm actually not a great one for memorabilia. But because the things that I would really love to own are things like the original Mr. Kite poster.
Yes. Yeah.
And I sort of think to myself, oh, well, who cares about a Shea Stadium ticket stub if I can't have that?
Yeah. That's the one thing I've noticed about being a Beatles fan is memorabilia. Same here. I'm not really that. I'd rather buy music than just look at something.
Yeah, yeah.
But try telling that to family members and friends at Christmas. It's just like a tea towel with Ringo. Oh, right, okay.
I know.
Just dreadful stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
I love you all, by the way.
Yeah, no, and I know it's very thoughtful, but I do feel like a lot of the time when somebody gives me a present, I simultaneously think I'm really touched that you took the time to choose this for me based on what you know to be my interests, and I just want to drop it in the dustbin. Like, if there's a bin in front of me, if that was socially acceptable, I'd just want to drop it in there.
I'm going to buy you a Beatles bin for Christmas. Just for that.
I'm surprised somebody hasn't.
Oh, there you go. It's interesting, as you say, with the dynamics. Paul is pretty well taking control at the moment. Later on, from sort of 67 and early 68, the power sort of went to George a bit as he was leading them to India. He was kind of taking control.
Yeah.
And I think when they came back from India, John had sort of, he had a long conversation with Derek Taylor, didn't he, about getting his ego back.
Mm.
So he was back in form. And it was, so sort of White Album time, all three of the main ones, they're all thinking, right, I'm taking control here.
And yeah.
Maybe that's where it begins, the friction might begin, perhaps.
But if you, I mean, I've not gone through the White Album with and made a tally, but I feel that as of Sgt. Pepper, the direction of the Beatles is largely steered by Paul. Oh, and the yeah. songs, not necessarily like my favourite songs, but the songs that people think of as you know, the high tide mark of the Beatles throughout that era, you know, are largely, not entirely, but sort of largely Paul songs, really.
Mm. After All You Need Is Love, every single was a Paul song.
Well, Ballad of John and Yoko.
So almost 2 years.
Yeah. Which, you know, John obviously resented.
Yeah.
And, you know, he said he got tired of being Paul's backing band.
Yeah.
I tell you what I would have liked to have heard is, you know, with Benefit of Mr. Kite, there's the story that they got the tape of the fairground organ Calliope music, and then they cut it up into 100 pieces, threw up it in the air, and then stuck it back together in a random order.
Yeah.
And they thought it was going to be amazing, but it wasn't. So then George Martin had to make something that had that effect but had a bit more structure to it, much like the orchestral climax on A Day in the Life.
Yes.
I would have loved to have heard what that sounded like.
Yes, absolutely. But would they want us to hear that?
No.
They wouldn't?
No, probably not.
One of the reasons I'm guessing they were so reluctant about anthology in the first place is, as you were saying earlier, everything was perfection. Also with things like What Do You See When You Turn Out the Light turning out to be a knob gag, that mystery is suddenly gone. And maybe it was partly that as well. They were happy to hold on to the mystery, you know, just hold back.
Yeah.
It's like being on social media, you're only showing the nice bits.
I'll tell you an astonishing thing in the first Mark Lewisohn book is, as a footnote, he mentions that Paul privately talks about how the first time he met John wasn't at the Village Fete, and it was outside.
Chip shop,
yeah, and that they'd chatted, but he sort of won't talk about that on record. And that, to me, suggests that there's a strong understanding of the myth.
Yes.
And the story.
Yeah.
But that was fascinating to me, and it was just a footnote. But I'd love to find out more about that.
Yeah, there was a thing, I think it was on the Daily Beetle website, where they were saying that the fish and chip shop in the recent Paul McCartney video is the actual one that is supposed to be where he met John. So maybe Paul's sort of throwing that out for the diehards.
Mm, the awareness of their own story. And I'll tell you what, you know, last time we were talking about things I would like, and I was saying about that I want every Beatles performance available at my fingertip on video. I would also like, and I'm amazed they haven't done it really, the Beatles anthology book in a format that you can actually sit down and read.
I know. You break your knee open with that.
Yeah,
thing.
Yeah.
It's so heavy.
And I've sort of downloaded a PDF of it one stage to my phone. But, I mean, I do think they, you know, they're obviously really focused on the back catalogue of records, but with stuff like that, just the anthology project in general, like, why isn't the anthology on Netflix with a big push behind it?
Yeah.
Because there's a generation of people, you know, young people who need to see it, because each generation discovers the Beatles and then fits it in with their own musical tastes.
Yeah.
It was maybe sort of dated slightly in some parts, but I think it's very, very well made, because there's so much archive material in it, and because they didn't really do anything Trixie. I mean, some of the choices of locations for interviews sort of look a bit odd. Yeah. You know, especially Paul stoking the fire or, yes, you know, yeah. Steering
just stoking the fire. Yeah. That's, anyway, 66.
Or on the boat.
Yes.
The Barnaby Rudge, his boat that he had, or sitting in front of a sound check.
Yeah.
I mean, he obviously had those visuals in his mind. He knew how he wanted, whereas yeah. I think George didn't care so much. He's like, let's go and sit in the back garden in the worst jacket you can possibly imagine. But why isn't that on Netflix? Because sure, yeah. In the same way as when the Beatles' music went onto Spotify or iTunes, it gets this huge push behind it. The same thing would happen if they put that documentary series on Netflix. I just think the anthology... I mean, they've missed the 25 years next year.
95.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So maybe, I mean, they'll be too busy with Let It Be. So they could do something else. I mean, does everything have to be pegged to an anniversary?
No.
Can't we just have some stuff because it'd be good to have it? But I was thinking about the anthology the other day, and, you know, there's sort of a Beatles book on everything. I think... a book on the origins of that project and what it took to make it come together, and the recording of the, you know, the songs that we talked about the last time, that would be a great book in its own
absolutely.
Right. And, you know, I know we're all waiting for Mark Lewisohn to do his three volumes, and, you know, I think we're in for a long wait, and, you know, you think, oh, I wish Mark Lewisohn could do it, though. I don't really... But in the absence of him doing it, somebody could step up. Peter Doggett, perhaps.
Picture yourself in a boat on a river with tangerine trees and marmalade skies. Somebody calls you, you answer quite slowly. A girl with kaleidoscope eyes.
Next, we have Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. Another composite. You've got part of take 6, tambura from take 7, and the chorus from the overdubs, which became take 8.
Yeah, when I listened to this again, I can't remember the last time I heard it. It wasn't one of the more memorable tracks on the anthology, and I wonder if it's, you know, for the reason you say, because it's a bit of a sort of hodgepodge lodge of lots of bits and pieces. The phrasing on the vocal is interesting, because everything's falling into place, but actually he sings it in quite a different way to the finished version, which I hadn't really considered how much that thing could change.
It's like a staccato picture. But every now and again he'll fall into the vocal styling that he eventually used. So I'm guessing he was learning as he was going through it.
His voice sounds like it's tearing in places a couple of times in this version as well, doesn't it? Which I always enjoy. No, it is.
Makes him fallible.
Yeah.
Moving on to Within You, Without You, the instrumental version.
Yeah. When I was younger, Within You, Without You was the song that sort of ruined Sgt. Pepper for me. Other people would say it's When I'm 64, but I've got a real soft spot for When I'm 64. I like, you know, hearing the flat northern vowel sounds on Chuck.
Oh, yes.
You know, I like the whoo at the end. I like the We Shall Scrimp and Save.
Yeah.
I think it's sort of... It's more as acerbic as a song than I think sometimes people give it credit for. But anyway, so then, you know, I always felt like, oh, I have to sit. Also, I think I've got a soft spot for When I'm 64. It's one of the, if not the first Beatles song I remember being aware of, because a man called Mr. Cutbush used to come into our school and play piano. And that was one of the songs that he played. Yeah, alongside sort of standards like My Grandfather's Clock or whatever, When I'm 64. The fact that it belonged to a pop band didn't occur to me until much later. So I know people find it a bit cloying, or you know, it's a Paul Granny music too far for some people. They're sort of not appreciating the pastiche. But for me, for a long time, Within You, Without You was the thing I had to sit through to get, and it's long as well. It's like it's 5.5, 6 minutes, something like that. But as I get older, I become more and more fond of it. For a long time, it was the music that fell into place with me. And, you know, I sort of thought, well, the melody of it is a bit nothingy. It's a bit monotone. But, you know, I even like that. I even like that now. I think it's a really beautiful song. But the previous incarnation of me would have enjoyed this because it didn't have the vocal and the melody.
Yeah,
you know, I don't feel very well informed on Indian music beyond George's stuff with the Beatles.
No.
And which when I went to that concert for George, the first half of it was Ravi Shankar and his orchestra. And I remember at the time thinking, this music is so beautiful. I really should put some time into finding out more about it beyond the Beatles,
Within You, Without You,
and The Inner Light and so on. But you know, I never have. But mate, you know, life is long, isn't it? Hopefully,
absolutely.
You gotta save some stuff up.
Next we have Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band reprise. I think the thing that strikes me about this was recorded 2 weeks after Jimi Hendrix had released Purple Haze. And if you think of the beginning, the dun 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 dun, I think there's a bit of an influence in there.
Well, we talked about this the last time, didn't we? I mean, they were great Magpies,
oh, yeah,
the Beatles. Very good at disguising it or feeding it through the filter that was the Beatles and it coming out as something quite different. But I hadn't made that connection, and as soon as you say it, that makes sense. I love the drums on this.
Oh, yeah.
I'm surprised nobody, you know, because this came out in the 90s when sort of sampling drums and drum loops was huge. I was surprised this didn't turn up anywhere. I mean, it's just that good. It really moves along. I used to wish, when I was on the radio, I always used to wish there was a longer, fast version of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, because you can't really play the one from the beginning of the album without them playing with a little help from my friends.
Yeah.
And you can't really glue the two versions of Sgt. Pepper together in any way that makes it sound coherent.
Yeah.
But when they brought out the Sgt. Pepper, actually it wasn't the reissue, it was when they brought out the mono box set, you know, Paul's little vocal ad libs towards the end of it, I'd never really been able to pick those out before, and it was thrilling, like genuinely thrilling to hear stuff that you hadn't noticed, which you do a lot with Beatles songs anyway, but they tend to be tiny things, not big things like that.
On the end of the box set version, you've got Paul singing "Hit Free Now," which is obviously he'd use later on the Liverpool Sound Collage.
Do you think a lot of people know about the Liverpool Sound Collage? I think people like you and I will, but
it was
an interesting project. So it was Paul going. I guess it was in the midst of him doing his Fireman stuff with Youth as well. But he went through bits of Beatles studio tapes and found speech and odd bits like that, and then sort of glued them together in some bits which sort of sound like a literal sound collage, Sounds of the Mersey Tunnel.
Yes,
but it was a bit, in a way, a precursor to Love, in that it took bits of the Beatles and glued them together into a new thing.
Yes, yeah, and Super Furry Animals.
Yes, of course,
as well.
Yeah,
bizarre and Youth.
Yeah, yeah, they'd got him chewing carrots on one of their songs,
That's
Furry
it.
Animals, yes. Which, you know, supposedly he'd done on the Beach Boys'
Vegetables.
Smile.
Mm.
Yes, yeah. Although he was interviewed in his fan club magazine Club Sandwich by Mark Lewisohn at some point and said that he'd got no memory of doing it.
I don't know. I think it's true.
I think it's true. And I think that, whether he remembers it or not, he now remembers it.
Yeah.
You know, in a very McCartney-ish way. Yeah. If it's part of the legend, he remembers it.
It was a fantastic time. Yeah. Celery was amazing. Next, we have You Know My Name, Look Up the Number.
I've got such a soft spot for this song.
Yes.
Now, for some people, the version that was on the B-side of Let It Be was plenty. Didn't need to go on any longer. I think that clocks in at the 4-minute-ish mark, but this goes on substantially longer, and I can't get enough of it. There's the story, and this speaks a little bit to what we were saying about John feeling like control of the band was slipping from his fingers and they were becoming Paul's backing band. There's this story about him wanting to release You Know My Name, Look at the Number, and What's the New Mary Jane as a double A-side.
Yeah.
And to the extent that they had acetates printed.
Yeah. December 5th was going to be the actual release date.
And then when the Beatles vetoed it, it was going to go out as a Plastic Ono Band record with the Beatles alluded to in the press release as, you know, backed by the greatest musicians on earth or whatever.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it is difficult to fathom what was going on in his mind from a commercial or business point of view. But if George's way of making a point was writing only a Northern song, then John's way of making a point was suggesting that as a single release.
Yeah.
But I do think, so aside from all the Goonsy stuff, which is great fun, I do think there's some, some of the sections of it sound like they could be sort of a genuinely good rock and roll record. And the sort of screaming vocals, I love it.
Yeah, well, the bit at the beginning that is rock vocals.
Yeah,
You Know My Name.
Yeah,
putting absolutely everything into this really whimsical song that should be throwaway. But John wanted to release that as a single for the Plastic Ono Band, which if he had have done. The Plastic Ono Band as a unit, it's almost sort of saying, well, Paul's on there, we're still together as a band. And it's the fact he didn't release that and sort of went with Cold Turkey. That's kind of, I'm John Lennon solo.
Mm.
So maybe that the reason it wasn't released was an argument or something. And the oh, well, stuff you, Paul, I'm going to release my sort of song. But
don't
know.
But it's great, isn't it? It Beatles is. Whimsy. I'm all for it, really.
Yeah.
I can also feel a bit like he needs my defence, but sort of defensive on Paul's behalf with all John's slurs about Paul's sort of granny music and silly music. The Goonsy side of You Know My Name, Look at the Number, things like Polytheme Pam or Bungalow Bill, these are all sort of silly songs or songs about characters or songs with stories. And it wasn't just Paul pulling the Beatles in that direction. They would both do it, but John would conveniently forget about that in the interviews he'd given. And to me, it's just, the variety of the Beatles is what sets them apart from other bands. You will sometimes hear them simplifying it to, well, we just wanted to do the songs that the other bands weren't doing in the club, so our repertoire was deeper. But I also think these weren't middle class London bohemian kids where sort of coolness fell into their laps. Like their coolness was sort of chased and earned, and there was a lot of uncoolness that they sifted through to get there. And the uncoolness, I think, is a huge part of what made them cool. The melodies from the type of music that Paul's dad would listen to or that John's mum would play him on the banjo. I think all that stuff, in addition to what rock and roll ignited in them, is what makes them a different class of band to any of the others.
Yeah. You think, again, Jimi Hendrix, he would never do When I'm 64.
No.
But that's kind of his level. He's doing that cool level.
Yeah.
But they've got the entire spectrum. They can do anything they want.
Yeah.
And in the context of the Beatles, yeah, it sounds a bit granny music, but it's cool.
Yeah.
The fact that they had the guts to release that, and it's brilliant.
Yeah.
But it's not in, you know, technically cool.
Which just makes them cooler.
Which does.
Yeah.
The difference with this version, we've got the scar section, which hasn't been heard before. A few other bits have been chopped out, oddly enough. So it does the ending with the... that gets faded out, which is the best bit, because it ends on that... which is the perfect ending of any... That was the last noise we heard on any Beatles output. That was the B-side of Let It Be.
I never thought about that.
The end of the Beatles' UK career was...
Oh, that's just wonderful. That's a beautiful thing.
It's lovely, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. I do sort of find all that stuff funny, you know, like on I'm So Tired as well, which I'm sure when somebody gets onto Anthology 3, you'll be able to talk about this with them, but all the kind of blah, 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 yeah. stuff. It's brilliant.
Yeah. I Am the Walrus. This is the first of three songs from the Magical Mystery Tour double EP.
Yeah, I now that you say that for a double EP, that seems like it's well represented on Anthology 3. Although I have previously felt that I'd like some more from that EP on here. And I think part of that could be because Fool on the Hill crops up twice. There's a demo version and the studio take. Yeah. This version, is it pre the Mike Sams singers and all that?
Yeah,
that's an odd thing that they were, because here's another contradiction. So when Paul breaks up the Beatles and he fires the warning shot across their bows with the letter detailing what's gone wrong with the Let It Be, with what Phil Spector's done with it, he specifically mentions the Long and Winding Road and the choir on it, and says we would never have a choir, we never have female voices on a Beatles record.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, there are quite a few examples of there being female voices on Beatles records, but this is one where they hired in. I think it might have even been the same choir, actually. It might have, the Mike Sams singers might have been the same people who were used by Phil Spector on Let It Be. And they were... They were very famous in the world of light entertainment at the time. And I think they did perhaps like theme songs to Gerry Anderson shows. Yes. Maybe Stingray and stuff like that was done.
Yeah.
By, so, you know, I do love all that. Umpah Umpah, Stick It Up Your Jumper, and Everybody's Got One and what have you. But, it's good to hear I'm the Walrus unadorned.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
I think this is a celebration of George Martin as well, because... Without the Mike Sands singers, without George Martin's orchestration, it's quite a dry sound. It needs that colour.
Yeah, like the lyric is sort of like brilliant surrealist poetry, but it just sort of plods along, doesn't it? It doesn't really go anywhere.
Yeah,
and by layering it in that way and bringing in different things at different stages of the song and the tuning of the radio, the song still doesn't go, it's still the same basic track, but all those adornments give the impression of it having more of a structure, perhaps.
I know Martin Carr from the Boo Radleys has got a theory, and I tried to follow it up once, that on the listing of the recording sessions, the Mike Sams singers have got D. Griffiths. And a while ago, there was a guy who claimed to be Derek Griffiths, and I asked him, was that you? He said, yes. And then it was later discovered that it wasn't Derek Griffiths.
This was the children's TV presenter, Derek Griffiths.
Yeah.
Who, and you're talking about when he popped up on Twitter for a while. Everybody got very excited, and then it turned out. Oh, no. So Martin Carr thinks it is Derek Griffiths on I Am the Walrus.
We put the question. I think there's every possibility that it could be, but... I don't know Derek Griffiths. If anybody knows Derek Griffiths, find out, because that would be the best thing.
This has to be discoverable information.
Yeah.
So some things are impossible. So I heard a great thing a while ago, which the person who told me made me promise that I wouldn't say where it had come from, but basically his best friend was the son of somebody who worked with the Beatles at a particular point in their career. And he said John Lennon had told him that when they, in the first days of Beatlemania, so they're huge in this country, but they're not global megastars, they're still staying in quite crummy hotels and B&Bs, but they can't leave the rooms because they're besieged by fans. Yeah. And John Lennon apparently said that what he would do to alleviate the boredom is take down pictures from the walls, take them out of their frames, then get the crummy prints and paintings and draw on the back, so, and then put them back again, but so you would never know.
Oh.
So in all these sort of hotels and B&Bs, really? Up and down England and Scotland and Wales, presumably hiding behind, you know, pictures of pastoral scenes and horses and things, there are these John Lennon drawings, which is a great story,
yes.
Isn't it? And
wow.
I thought that would, like, hunting for those things would make a good sort of documentary or something of that ilk. But the problem was nobody could verify the story because this person didn't want to sort of go on record. I don't know why. I mean, it's not a scandal.
No, really. I'm guessing there's a lot of hotels that would be a bit worried that, you know, everybody that comes in is now going to demolish all of their paintings trying to find these.
Although you're imagining they've had a refurb. I mean, I've been in some ropey B&Bs, but most of them you'd hope would have had a refurb since 1963.
Well, yeah. Well, not some of the ones I've stayed in, to be fair, but yeah. Oh, I love all stuff like that.
Yeah, it's great, isn't it? And I tried to, you know, just find somebody who... So I asked Mark Lewis and he said it's a good story, but I've never heard that.
Yeah.
And I got in touch with a few people just on the off chance it had been mentioned to them. One of them was May. I thought, I wonder if May Pang, she seems like somebody that's easy to get hold of on the internet. So I wrote May Pang an email and she wrote me back saying, oh, this is a great story. It sounds just like the sort of thing John would have done, but he never mentioned it to me. Yeah.
Day after day, alone on a hill, the man with the foolish grin is sitting perfectly still. Nobody wants to know him, they can see that he's just a fool. For he never gives an answer, but the fool...
Next we have The Fool on the Hill. We've got a demo version, Then Your Mother Should Know, and then Fool on the Hill, take 4. So the demo version has been sort of doing the rounds for a while. It's Paul on the piano.
Yeah, and the words aren't quite finished.
Yeah,
are they? It's never sort of the most exciting part of this anthology CD for me, The Fool. I mean, I love the song, but I'm not sure really that either of these, because it's quite a simple song anyway. And of course, when the recorders are on it, it sounds fantastic, and they're sort of round. But I didn't feel like I learned a lot about it. I mean, I will listen to any, as we established, I'll listen to anything, and, you know, if there is a missing word or a slightly changed word. But, I like the sequence in the film, and I love the story about Paul going off to Nice to record it and not having a passport.
Yes.
But being so famous that they just let him through anyway.
Yeah.
And, you know, that is a definition of fame that maybe, like, could that exist in the world today, where you could travel internationally with no passport, thinking about both ends, wherever you're traveling to, because you're that famous, your face is enough of a passport?
Probably still Paul, I
guess. Yeah.
Unless you're the royalty presidents or Paul McCartney.
Yeah.
I'd say Paul McCartney is probably the only one.
It's astonishing, isn't it? And, you know, when I think of the south of France as well, you think of the sort of sun-kissed French Riviera. And if you didn't know, he's wearing the big overcoat. I mean, it could be in the Scottish lowlands, couldn't it?
Yeah, that's such a great thing to do, though. Just, right, guys, stay here. I'm just going to nip off to... And it's this beautifully produced piece as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
A lot of time and effort went into that.
Yeah.
Bless him.
With imposing. What are your views on Magical Mystery Tour as a film?
Love it.
I love it. I used to think I just like watching the musical performances. And I think I mentioned last time, through my three-year-old son's eyes, I've grown to love it.
Yes, you were saying, yeah. Because that must be a weird thing to watch as a kid. Or maybe that is a better way to watch as a kid.
Well, the reason I put it on for him was he's obsessed with cars and buses and trains and things. So I thought, how can I sort of indoctrinate him with the Beatles, but using his existing interest in vehicles? So I thought about the bus going around the track, and we worked outwards from there, and he will just sort of have the whole thing on and just watch it, including, you know, the stripper at the end, which is, of course, censored.
Yeah.
So I don't feel too bad about it.
He really
loves the bit where the footage from Iceland.
Flying,
yeah, where it changes colours. He shouts out the different colours.
Yeah.
Well, that was
Kubrick, wasn't it? Unused Kubrick footage.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Actually, now you say it, it's setting something off in my mind, but wow.
Yeah.
Well, and then the other Kubrick one is that they wanted, when they had this idea that they wanted to be the first people to do a film of The Lord of the Rings.
Yes.
They asked Stanley Kubrick to direct it, didn't they?
Yeah. Tolkien wasn't having it, though. I think they had it cast as well, didn't they? I think that could have been the nadir of anything they could have ever made.
Oh, yeah, it would have been terrible. I'm so pleased that it didn't happen.
Wasn't John Lennon Gollum?
Yeah, John was going to be Gollum, Paul was going to be Frodo, Ringo was going to be Sam, and George was going to get Gandalf.
Yeah.
So there's sort of like big casting holes there already, aren't there?
He had the beard. That's about it. There could have also been another film in 67, Up Against It, which was written by Joe Walton, which would have been taken them into a completely different direction.
Several shades darker
than
what they'd all...
Yeah.
How different do you think Magical Mystery Tour would or wouldn't have been if Brian had lived?
Difficult to say, because his fear at the time, wasn't it, when they stopped touring, that he was losing control of them. They clearly loved him.
Yeah.
And he'd lost so much confidence that they would have just gone ahead and done it, and he would have said, yeah, whatever.
Mm.
I was there the help around at the time?
I don't think so.
It had been now,
yes,
he would have had the help and support to get over whatever his demons were, but it just wasn't around, was it? He's one of those you just don't think at the time, how could he have, you know, he wasn't made for old bones, I guess.
No. I do love that film now. I've grown to love it. Although I maintain that the opening number, Magical Mystery Tour, with the clips of the film, it looks like it's going to be the greatest Technicolor romp.
Yeah, it does.
If it was, you know, it's like when you watch a trailer to a film. You know, they use all the best bits. And so pacey. It doesn't quite deliver on those first 2 minutes, much as I love it.
No. I remember it was one Christmas they showed all the films. A Magical Mystery Tour, same thing. I remember watching it and thinking, wow, this is going to be awesome. It's around the Sgt. Pepper era. And then I was just thinking, when's it actually going to start? I thought it was like a preamble and then it ended.
Yeah.
It was like, oh, okay. I love it. Love it now.
Yeah, I do. And you know, it was, as we discussed at the beginning, 1967 was the most astonishing year for them. And that was another expression of their creativity in the most astonishing of years. So it's, you know, infinitely interesting just from that point of view. Although when I'm watching them dressed as wizards and Ringo sort of hobbling around the room going, where's the bus? Where's the bus? Where's the bus? It's difficult. Difficult to see the genius in certain bits.
Yeah.
Lift up your hearts and sing me a song that was a hit before your mother was born. Though she was born a long, long time ago, your mother should know. Your mother.
mother should know. So your mother should know.
It almost sounds military, this one. It's very sparse and it's a bit creepy.
Yeah.
In a way.
You've got the Ringo.
Yeah, yeah. And they got the false start and the with Siggy. Is it this the with Siggy in mouth?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, this is another one of those Paul songs that I think not everybody loves, but I really love it. And, you know, when you think, okay, if I could time travel, if I just get to be somewhere for 5 minutes, I think probably Hamburg or the Cavern when they're at the peak of the Powers as a live band. But I'd also love to be in that aircraft hangar for the big finish to Magical Mystery Tour. It's joyous, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. John's fixed grin.
Yeah, yeah. but they are enjoying, you know, they are enjoying themselves. I'm curious to know what it is with Paul, with the points of difference that people then start picking up on as clues, like the, you know, that he chose the black carnation out of the tray of carnations that was presented to them, or he didn't wear shoes on the, it was a hot day. I wonder if there's something in him that just wanted to be, even though they were this four-headed monster as they were described, you know, there was something about him that wanted to be a bit more individual within the group, even though he was the one that wanted to hold the group together.
Yeah. Well, you'd think, again, your mother should know at the end, they're doing the dance routine, but he's the one that's sort of jumping up and spinning round.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I don't know, maybe it's playing up to the camera, I don't know.
I don't think any of them are great dancers.
No.
And I think Ringo, who, you know, he's the worst of the lot, and
have
he's
you
the
seen
drummer.
A Hard Day's Night?
Oh, yeah,
he's
yeah.
He's dancing in the... Oh, yeah. Dear, oh, dear.
Yeah.
Ringo.
But isn't that surprising for a drummer? Shouldn't the drummer be the best dancer?
Yeah.
I'm not a dancer myself, so I find these things difficult to conceive of. But it is always, even in what I think is probably quite a simple move, which is the steps down the stairs, he seems slightly out.
I'm going to have to look at that.
Do, yeah.
Because this version as well, it's got the harmonium, which we hadn't heard since We Can Work It Out.
Right, yeah, yeah.
And then we never heard it anyway because they didn't use this version.
Yeah. So.
I think because John originally saw one lying around in the corner of the studio and, yeah, we'll do that and we can work
That's
it
interesting
out.
That it never cropped back up again, isn't it?
Yeah. I suppose it's so synonymous with We Can Work It Out and they never liked to really repeat themselves, did they?
Yeah. You say yes, I say no. You say stop, and I say go, go, go.
Oh, oh no. You say goodbye, and I say hello. Hello, hello. Hello, goodbye. And this is take 16, which is not that dissimilar to the version that we know.
Yeah, so is it one of these where George is kind of answering the vocal with his guitar?
Yeah.
Which, you know, as we all know, led to arguments and was rarely a good idea, but he'd give it the old college try anyway.
Yeah.
I like Hello Goodbye, and I mainly, you know, I know it's a throwaway pop song, but I love the end, especially the hey la, hey ba, hello. I think that bit is so great and sounds brilliant the way the drums are. But, you know, you could also see it from John Lennon's point of view if he's writing things like I'm the Walrus and this is what ends up coming out as a single. That was probably frustrating and it, you know, probably felt a bit smiley compared to where they were at. But, you know, you watch the various takes of the video to this song, and I think they're enjoying themselves.
Yeah. There's one in particular, isn't there, where they're dancing and...
Yeah, and I think they, you know, I think when the hula dancing ladies come on, they're particularly enjoying themselves.
Johnny seems very entranced.
Yes, he does, yeah. I've often wondered what happened next.
Yeah.
Like what kind of an evening they had.
Other than that little part of George's guitar mirroring the vocals, it's not really that much different. And there's a few tracks that are on here. It's almost like the last part of this anthology too is just trying to fill it up just so we can get to Across the Universe.
Yeah. And which is weird to me because, you know, like you said earlier, when we finally got the Sgt. Pepper box set, it's not like there is a dearth of stuff. There's loads of it, and I'm guessing the same applies to Magical Mystery Tour. It was a stage at which they were trying stuff out in different studios.
Yes. There's Chapel.
Yeah, and you know, a bit later at Trident and Olympic. I wonder, was Baby You're a Rich Man, which was also sort of around now-ish, yes, was that done at Olympic?
Yeah.
I read a great thing the other day. There's a George Harrison account I follow on Instagram, and it's just like lovely pictures of George Harrison and then bits of various interviews and books. And there's a bit from Klaus Voormann's autobiography, which I think was published in the early 2000s, but never translated into English.
Brilliant.
You know, the bits are quite clumsily translated, but they're always great. And Klaus talks about the last time he saw George, and you know, he was looking bad. A lot of his hair had gone and one of his teeth had fallen out. And George said, "I want to show you my latest video production." So goes over to the TV, switches it on, puts a video in the machine, and it's him, you know, balding, toothless and very ill-looking, just playing ukulele into the camera and singing "How Does It Feel to Be One of the Beautiful People?"
Really?
Yeah, which I thought was lovely and sort of, you know, there is the man's sense of humour on display. Because didn't he also, was it that song that when we hear about him going to San Francisco and he's rescued by the Hells Angels, doesn't he sort of play that for the assembled crowd of hippies?
Yeah,
that's interesting.
He was just walking with the acoustic guitar.
Yeah, and that's interesting to me. You know, he's there playing a Lennon and McCartney song. So I do wonder, although, you know, I'm not sure, if the sessions aren't as well documented when they're outside of EMI studios.
Mm. I think Mark Lewiston said that, hasn't he?
Right, right.
Very much so.
Yeah.
Everything was so clinical.
Yeah.
Abbey Road.
Yes. Yeah, it's a funny one because this definitely felt, as we talked about last time, this anthology too, in some ways, feels like the best of the three releases. Mm-hmm. But as we sit here looking at disc two, and when it came out, I mean, this was the stuff I was the most interested in and excited by. But there's more filler than I remember there being, or, you know, more versions of songs that aren't that dissimilar to the finished versions.
We end 67 and start into 1968 with Lady Madonna.
And again, so am I right in remembering this is a bit more sort of kazooey in the middle and there's not as much of the brass on it? Yeah.
It's another composite.
Yeah.
So it takes three and four. There's a slightly different solo, sax solo.
Yeah.
I can't really... Yeah, there's not really that much different to the official version.
One of the great moments of my life is when I worked for a long time at Virgin Radio. They then got sold to the Times of India, a big Indian conglomerate, who changed the name to Absolute Radio. And when they launched it, they wanted to, you know, they wanted to imbue the DNA of the radio station with, you know, rock and roll. So they went and recorded the little, not quite jingles, but sonic idents at Abbey Road Studios. Mm-hmm. And they made a video of, you know, of that evening where they recorded this stuff.
Right.
And for it, you know, they got the Lady Madonna piano there. They said, "Jeff, you can play a bit of piano. Would you play Lady Madonna on it?" Now, I can't really play a bit of piano. I can play chords. So they paid for me to go into a rehearsal room in Primrose Hill. And for three afternoons, I sat there with a laptop and YouTube learning how to play the intro to Lady Madonna from a YouTube video. And then I got to go in the studios and play Lady Madonna on the Lady Madonna piano, which was a great moment. Although I was in Abbey Road last week and I was chatting to Giles Martin, who I know a little bit, and
Could put in a word, much appreciated.
I think he's sick of talking about the Beatles.
If you want to talk about
that, something else, I'm sure he'd do it.
Talk about his holidays,
He was pretty sure, like, he is of the opinion that everybody says because it was the piano made famous by Mrs. Mills.
Mm.
he's pretty sure that that wasn't the Lady Madonna piano. He thinks they used it on loads of other stuff, like Penny Lane. But there's another piano in there which looks unremarkable, which I've always been told is the Fool on the Hill piano. It looks like a modern piano you'd find in a primary school.
Right.
If that makes sense.
Yeah.
And his feeling is that is the Lady Madonna piano, which has slightly robbed me of this great moment of my life where I thought I'd played Lady Madonna in Studio 2 on the Lady Madonna piano.
You played on a piano.
Yeah.
In Abbey Road.
Yes. That'll do. I'll take it.
Don't ask any more questions. Yeah. You played on the one. Isn't there? There's one with a bit of a cigarette burn on there as well.
Yeah,
I seem to remember.
Yeah, it is incredible if you ever go in there, just how this stuff is just lying around.
Yeah.
You know, if this was in America, the different bits would have either been sold off to collectors, or you'd go in and it'd be some kind of museum. It all behind glass, and maybe somebody be able to tell you about it, or if you're a rich person you could hire it for a private function and touch it. But it's a working studio, and this is the stuff, the tools that live in that studio, and anybody can use them, and it's a beautiful thing.
We had the joy of interviewing Neil Innes Abbey Road recently, and the studio we were in, the guy that was doing it, Tom, saying, oh, just the other side of this wall, that's where all the tapes are. What? Really? What time are you going? And it was, they were just on the other side of that wall.
Wow.
Words are flowing out like endless rain into a paper cup. They slither wildly as they slip away across the universe. Pools of sorrow, waves of joy are drifting through my opened mind, possessing and caressing me. Jaguru Deva.
We end with Across the Universe, and this is recorded on 3rd of February 1968, and it's take 2, which is probably, I know you say, While My Guitar Gently Weeps, this probably is my favourite.
Yeah, this proves me wrong, actually, because of course this is better than either of the released versions. I will make these statements full of certainty, and then the second you say that, this is better than either the World Wildlife version or the thing that came out on Let It Be. It's just gorgeous, and it's so weird that it sat around for so long. Did they not understand what they had on their hands with this song? John must have done.
Yes.
John must have understood this was, from the same box as Strawberry Fields Forever and You've Got to Hide Your Love Away. It's that level of good, and, so quintessentially him as well. And you hear about him waking up and the words coming to him, and it just sounds like that as well.
Yes.
And I know sort of lyrically that is alluded to, but it just feels like it's falling out of him. It's just a beautiful, beautiful recording. Mm.
They recorded this, and then obviously Lady Madonna was the single, so that was Paul again. Then they headed off to India, did all of that, came back, and they were focused on their new songs. So I think that's probably when they gave it to the World Wildlife Fund.
Yeah.
And forgot about it. But then they were still doing it in Let It Be Get Back sessions.
Mm-hmm.
But some of the recordings of that is just so slow, and he kind of gave up on it. And it was Phil Spector. Well, I guess Glyn Johns we have to thank for digging out the original version.
So it's just the foot was off the gas with it. Because people forget how long John and George were gone for. It was a long old time, wasn't it?
Yeah, months and months and months.
Yeah, so... Mm. But it's astonishing. It's, one of his most beautiful songs and the most beautiful version of it.
Mm. So, Jeff, Anthology 2, how would you sum up this collection? Is it a curio, or is it part of the Beatles canon?
So I don't think anything that wasn't released by the Beatles when there were four of them, and they were still functioning together as a unit, is canon necessarily. But I was excited to do this album, and I thought nobody's done the anthologies yet, and my memory, this was my favourite one. I've loved going back to it. It does seem like a little bit weaker than I remember it being, but I think, you know, as we've covered, it's because we're so spoiled now with the Sgt. Pepper and White album and the other box sets that hopefully will follow it. But it's still wonderful. What a thing to have this. When you think we were just going to get that Sessions LP, to have had these three double albums, which, you know, span different sections of the career. Like, we're really lucky to have this stuff and have it in a way that doesn't mean searching for bootlegs, and it's the audio quality is good. Still, though, like, some of the stuff that doesn't end up on it is baffling. I was thinking about one. It's, to be fair, it's not this album, but it should have been on Anthology 3. It should have been on the White Album box set. It still hasn't come out. The in-between version of Revolution.
Yeah.
So it's fast, but still has the shooby-doo, like they did on the David Frost show.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, why haven't we got that? Like, they spent all that time on that White Album box set. Why haven't we got that?
I don't know.
It's bizarre. But I've loved coming back to it. I really have. And, you know, just talking about this stuff, I would, like I said, it's my neutral. It's most of what I'm thinking about anyway. So to sit here and talk about it with somebody who's as interested as I am is just a joy.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been a joy. Thank you so much, Jeff. All the best. And hopefully have you on again one day. But it's been an absolute pleasure.
Thanks for having me. We're about an hour and 20.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm sorry. Yeah. Sorry, it amuses me.
What's wrong with me?
No, it's awesome.